Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the last-minute influx of dark money to support a venal and misleading so-called political reform proposition on the California ballot. Derek Cressman, the Vice President for State Operations for Common Cause, joins us to discuss efforts to prevent anonymous billionaires from buying the election with $11 million that has been laundered through a series of fronts that appear to have the fingerprints of Karl Rove and the Koch brothers. Then we will speak with Matthew Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin, where President Obama and Bruce Springsteen held a final campaign rally yesterday. We will discuss the division and dilemma amongst progressives who want to voice their opposition to the president's policies without helping elect a reactionary representative of the 1% who is beholden to Tea Party extremists. Then finally, we'll try to interpret Paul Ryan's charge that President Obama is putting America, quoting, on a dangerous path that compromises Judeo-Christian Western civilization values. Sarah Posner, the senior editor at Religion Dispatches, joins us to discuss last-minute attempts to whip up religious fervor amongst Christian fundamentalists to vote against their nemesis, the Antichrist, Barack Hussein Obama. Joining us now is Derek Cressman, the Vice President for State Operations of Common Cause, where he's leading Common Cause's effort to amend the Constitution to reverse Citizens United versus the FEC. In 2011, he played a leading role in organizing an Uncloak the Kochs rally in Palm Springs, California, exposing the hundreds of millions of dollars that Koch Industries and other allied billionaires have spent to influence the political process. He has testified before the United States Senate, California Assembly and Senate, California Fair Political Practice Commission, and is the author of The Recall's Broken Promise, How Big Money Still Runs California Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Derek Cressman.
It's great to be here, Ian.
And with this lead story in the Los Angeles Times on the very day of this critical election indicates that this is a big story with national implications, certainly because there's nationwide money laundering going on here with the money that's been sent into California from Arizona to affect two of the key propositions, one on education, Proposition 30, and the other one, Proposition 32, which is a mendacious effort on the part of a handful of billionaires to, in the name of getting money out of politics, to enable themselves to be able to dominate politics in perpetuity by limiting the ability of unions to put their side of the story forth. So the fact that this money, this $11 million, which the Attorney General of California is trying to find, it started out with Virginia-based Americans for Job Security. It was transferred to a group called Center to Protect Patient Rights. And then in October, it was sent to an Arizona group, Americans for Responsible Leadership, and then it's been transferred into California. Where does it stand now, Derek?
Well, what we know so far is that, as you just described, Ian, somebody went to an awful lot of effort to try to keep what they were doing secret. And we now know minimally, you know, as a result of the actions by the California Attorney General and the Fair Political Practices Commission, that the people promoting Prop 32, claiming to be, you know, in favor of getting money out of politics, turn out to be a bunch of cowardly crooks and liars. We still haven't gotten completely to the bottom of it, in that we don't know who originally gave the money to that first group that you mentioned, the Americans for Job Security organization, but we do know that that's a highly partisan outfit that has been around for more than 10 years. They have some ties to Karl Rove, and they have a history of doing this type of thing. And in fact, they reached a settlement in Alaska where they paid a fine, I believe, of $20,000, and admitted to using their nonprofit status essentially just to shield the identity of a donor in a ballot measure up there. So these are unseemly people we're dealing with.
So, Derek Cressman, the last in the chain so far, this group in Arizona, Americans for Responsible Leadership, What we found out about them is that they are represented by a law firm in Virginia, which is where the money originated from, by the way. And that law firm shares a mailing address with American Crossroads, which is Karl Rove's outfit. And the other group that received this money and then passed it on to the Arizona group, the Center for to Protect Patient Rights, is run by Sean Noble, who's a key participant and a former employee of Charles and David Koch. So it's not unreasonable to suggest that both Karl Rove and the Koch brothers are simply hiding their fingerprints on this money, because already the Kochs have gotten a reputation, I think, in part thanks to you, for being these venal oligarchs who are out to buy our democracy.
Yeah, all the evidence is pointing to the fact that there's this highly sophisticated network of essentially shell organizations, so-called nonprofit groups, that primarily serve just as conduits to launder money from folks like Charles and David Koch and the folks that attend their fundraising seminars and people that Karl Rove is raising money from. And I think after our last election in California, where there was a global warming question on the ballot, and voters found out, in fact, that it was companies like Valero and Tesoro and Koch Industries that were backing that measure, and once they learned that, it went down to defeat. I think the Kochs have gone to even greater lengths to try to conceal their identities, because they're worried that if voters know who's behind their efforts, that they'll look at them pretty skeptically.
Well, these two oil companies that you mentioned, these two Texas oil companies, Valero and Tesoro, they're in the process of trying to get a monopoly on all of California's refining capability. And recently, the price of gasoline was run up in a way that defied all market logic, prompting Senator Feinstein to question how much the price of gas in California was being manipulated, because there was no shortage of gas, but suddenly the price spiked. So this is what these companies are about. They're about fleecing the state, just like Enron did with the phony power crisis. And I'm just astounded that the people of the state of California aren't able to get the real information here, you know, thanks to you and the California Attorney General Kamala Harris. You know, at least we're getting some information, but it feels like, given that we're talking about this on the day of the election, that the barn door's open and the horse is down the paddock.
Yeah, that's certainly right. I mean, probably more than half of Californians had already cast their ballots by mail before this information, hit the newspapers and the airwaves. And, in part, it looks as though, like, these characters have gotten away with an illegal $11 million contribution that wasn't properly disclosed. We are looking at what steps we can take at Common Cause to deter future behavior like this, both by continuing to make sure that this particular set of bad actors sees the full enforcement of the law, and that could include fines, that could include a requirement that the Small Business Action Committee, which was the final recipient of these funds, have to pay $11 million to this HR fund. That's actually what the California Campaign Finance Statute requires. So we think there's some things that can still be done to ferret out this behavior and to bring this particular set of folks to justice. But more importantly, we want to look at how we can strengthen and streamline the disclosure law so that next time around, voters have earlier access to complete and full information about who's trying to influence their vote.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Derek Cressman, who's the Vice President for State Operations of Common Cause. where he's leading Common Cause's efforts to amend the Constitution to reverse Citizens United versus the FEC. In 2011, he played a lead role in organizing an Uncloak the Coke rally in Palm Springs, California, exposing the hundreds of millions of dollars that Coke Industries and allied billionaires have spent to influence the political process. Now, the California Supreme Court met on Sunday, and they really made a very, very quick decision here. So it looks like everything's being done to, you know, to smoke out this hidden money and this last-minute injection of $11 million from out of state to affect a proposition, again, a very mendacious proposition, Prop 32, which is dressed up as political reform, when in fact it is the most reactionary and greedy power grab imaginable, enabling billionaires and oligarchs to essentially dominate California politics in perpetuity by tying the hands of any other smaller grassroots or union organization that would want to put forth an opposing viewpoint. So there's a lot at stake here.
Yes, and you can imagine if you were a billionaire or an oligarch trying to, weaken the hand of your political opponents, you might try to do that in a way that didn't have your fingerprints on it. And that's exactly what we were seeing here. You're quite right to note the really remarkable step that the California Supreme Court took to meet in an emergency session by conference call on a Sunday afternoon and to vote unanimously, 7-0, force this rogue group, you know, the Americans for Responsible Leadership, quote-unquote responsible, to comply with the audit that the Fair Political Practices Commission was doing. It was, you know, fairly historic act by the courts, by Anne Revell at the commission, and by Attorney General Kamala Harris. And it was somewhat encouraging for me to see that, you know, the enforcement agencies and the courts that Californians depend upon actually did step up to the plate here and do their level best to try to get this information out. You don't always see that type of robust enforcement, but we really did here, I think, because this particular $11 million was so large and so obviously hiding its source. It was really offensive to people all across the state.
But Derek Crespin, the idea that you can launder this money and it can bounce around the country and discuss, and of course with these 501c4 nonprofit vehicles, these super PACs that Karl Rove and others are exploiting now that allow billionaires to donate money anonymously, and more importantly and more disturbingly, corporations can also give money and not be identified. Of course, corporations are very concerned about their customers knowing where their money goes and to whom. And since half of their customers are Democrats and half of their customers are Republicans, they're normally restrained from being overtly political. But with these so-called social welfare vehicles, 501c4s, and the IRS has not looked into any of them. And by the way, the minute the election's over, they can dissolve these vehicles. So they never existed. So we've got a broken federal election commission. They're absolutely useless. And we've got all this money pouring in and all of the chicanery going on. It would seem to me that we need the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration. We need trained people who've worked on money laundering cases to get into the electoral process here.
Yeah, I think you're quite right, and we need to see a much more robust Internal Revenue Service, which is, you know, the entity that these so-called social welfare groups are filing their returns with to conduct audits at that level. Unfortunately, I share your assessment of the Federal Elections Commission, but what we are seeing literally just in the course of the past week is now three states have had success in starting to pierce the veil that these so-called nonprofits are putting up. You know, we saw this progress here in California, but also in Idaho. The Secretary of State went to court there and enforced a 30-year-old sunshine law that forced a ballot a group spending money in a ballot committee there to reveal its donors. And just recently in Montana, the Office of Political Practices up there went to court and forced another one of these shadowy groups called American Traditions Partnerships to reveal their donors. So we're starting to see more robust enforcement coming from state enforcement agencies than we're seeing at the federal level. And, you know, maybe what we need to do is just make sure that those entities have the resources that they need, and we see other state attorneys general like Kamala Harris stepping up to the plate. That might be more fruitful than federal action, which we may be a long time waiting for.
Well, Derek Crespin, I appreciate you joining us here today. And obviously the fight will go on after the election, and I just, you know, I'm quite concerned about the extent to which they've already gotten away with this, that we're playing catch up here, that's the way the system is now designed.
Yes, it is, and I appreciate your interest in it and your efforts to inform your listeners about it. So thank you, and have a good day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Derek Crespin, who's the Vice President for State Operations of Common Cause, where he's leading Common Cause's efforts to amend the Constitution to reverse Citizens United versus the FEC. In 2011, he played a lead role in organizing the Uncloak the Coke rally in Palm Springs, California, exposing the hundreds of millions of dollars that Coke Industries and allied billionaires have spent to influence the political process. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the editor of the Progressive magazine. And joining us now is Matthew Rothschild, who is the editor of the Progressive magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin. He is one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rothschild.
Hey, thanks for having me back, huh?
And your state, Wisconsin, is obviously important. The president, in effect, although he went on to Iowa, his big kind of keynote rally was in Madison with Bruce Springsteen joining him on Air Force One and performing. Were you at the rally?
I sure was. It was kind of thrilling to be there with Springsteen, sing some of his classics, including Darkness at the Edge of Town. He also was clowning up on the stage, doing some stand-up kind of poorly in my mind, but he was in a good mood, in a bullion mood at that, actually, and so was the president. And then the president gave a really good speech. He gave a progressive speech. He talked about the people at the very top not needing a champion in the White House, but other people actually needing a champion. The restaurant owner who can't get a loan, the student who can't pay the tuition, the farmer who is having trouble, the poor kids in the inner cities and in rural areas who don't get a shot at a decent education, a worker looking for a job. I mean, all those people need a champion in the White House, and he pledged to be that champion.
So, obviously, Wisconsin is one of the swing states, and I'm puzzled as to why this election is supposedly so close, and I'm not entirely trustful of the mainstream press. I think they have a motive in making it a cliffhanger because that keeps people tuned into their television, listening to their radio, or reading their newspapers. But that aside, how close do you think it is?
Well, I think it's a close race. I think Obama's going to win, though. I think he's winning in the important swing states. But we have a really divided country. You know, I used to think that the right wing in this country was, or the far right wing, was only 5 or 10%. But now I think it's closer to, 25%. And if you mix that with the corporatist right wing, you've got you know, 45% of the public that is very hostile to any Democrat, and especially a black Democrat in the White House. You know, we saw a button here in Wisconsin over the last week at a Romney rally that said, "Vote Romney, it's the white thing to do." And, you know, this racism just below the surface here, that's not below the surface, that bubbled over. But it's sad after, you know, all the gains we thought we made on race relations just in getting Obama in last time around. I mean, the corrosive, vile attitude of racists hasn't gone away. In fact, it's gotten worse in some degrees. I mean, that's one of the reasons you see all the so-called enthusiasm on the Republican side. Some of that enthusiasm is racist enthusiasm.
Well, I don't mean to beat up on the press, Matthew Rothschild, but I do find it extraordinary that Romney's gotten away with not revealing his taxes or revealing his list of money bundlers, which other presidents before him have. And if he is elected president, he will set a very dangerous precedent where future presidents won't have to reveal how much money they have, who they got it from. And, you know, that is important political DNA. The other thing is, of course, that so much about his connection to the Mormon Church, and the Bloomberg had a story just on Monday that was overshadowed by the storm of how Romney's perhaps been using the Mormon Church to shelter his income. So while the Tea Party people are out there with their racist rants, I think that's something that, you know, it's sad but not surprising. What is, I think, even sadder is that both the Democrats and the press simply failed us in smoking out who this candidate is, Mitt Romney.
Well, yeah, they didn't smoke him out. They were smoking him out in September. And let's remember, Romney had a horrible September. It was the worst September since the Chicago Cubs swooned in 1969. I mean, he had that problem with his tax returns. And I think he ran away from that problem by, you know, plucking Paul Ryan from Wisconsin to be his vice presidential candidate and tried to change the topic and ended up kind of successfully changing the topic that way. And then he was helped by Obama sleepwalking through the first debate. And so that whole issue of his tax returns kind of vanished in the swirl of events. But I agree with you. I mean, it's ludicrous that he didn't need to release his tax returns. I mean, Paul Ryan and the other people who was vetting for vice president had to release their tax returns to Romney, who was trying to choose a vice president. Why couldn't the American public see tax returns from Romney when we're trying to choose a president? And that whole thing was ludicrous. But I also think that Romney, as a vulture capitalist, hurt Romney ultimately. I think the fact that he is super rich and seemed to be running as a multimillionaire for the billionaires has hurt him. And that's one of the reasons why the contrast between his position on lowering taxes for the wealthy versus Obama's position late in the game, at least rhetorically trying to be the champion of working people, has played to Obama's favor.
Well, of course, you have this alternative universe, Matthew Rothschild, where Fox News is reporting all the time about Benghazi and trying to make that into a story. And, you know, some of the extraordinary things that Romney said, particularly about the storm, where he talked about how he, and when he was a student, he had to clean up a football field of, you know, paper cups and hot dog wrappers. And, you know, I was just astounded that somebody could be that out of touch.
Well, I think that's, I mean, he always was a bad candidate. He's a very awkward human being with no social skills whatsoever. I mean, he's got the social skills of a garbanzo bean. I mean, this is a guy who is really ill-suited for the political give and take and retail politics. That's why he says ridiculous things like that. And Sandy was a huge benefit for Obama politically. It was a horrible tragedy. He handled it very professionally and with great presidential leadership. And then Chris Christie in New Jersey, you know, gave Obama tens of millions of dollars of worth of paid advertisements by embracing the president. And that has shifted the momentum in the last 10 days, and momentum is big in these races. That's why I think these polls have shifted in state after state and nationally, and Obama has been gaining pretty steadily ever since the storm.
Well, of course, a lot of people have already voted. So the effect of that last-minute swing may be offset a little bit. Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin. He is one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Being the editor of the Progressive magazine, you're right in the middle of this split amongst progressives who both support Obama and who are mad at Obama and will vote for the Green Party or somebody else. Have you been engaged in a lot of these arguments? Because the thing that occurs to me about this whole idea of being able to vote your conscience, if you will, and protest what you don't like about the Obama administration by voting for the Green Party or Peace and Freedom or whatever, I'm astounded why in this country, given the history of the duopoly and how the system is rigged, it has become an issue that somehow we've conflated voting with political organizing, and they're totally two separate things.
Well, they are. And, you know, I've wrestled with this third party dilemma for more than 20 years, 25 years here at the Progressive. I wrote an article back in 1989 called Third Party Time? And then I wrote a cover story here just in our September issue on called The Third Party Dilemma, where I interviewed Jill Stein of the Green Party and I interviewed some other people on the left, like Katha Pollitt at The Nation, and wrestled with this issue as to, you know, whether you vote your conscience. Those of us who've been very critical of President Obama for his escalating the war in Afghanistan, for his drone warfare, for his assassination doctrine, for the National Defense Authorization Act and how horrible that is for civil liberties and for dragging his feet on global warming and for being prepared to compromise on Social Security with John Boehner and all those things. But, you know, I'm not going to tell people who to vote for, and I resent it when people tell me who to vote for. And I just think there are reasons why people can go either way. And so it's been tough for me personally, and sorting it through is always a problem that every person needs to do on their own accord. But generally, you know, I agree with you about the duopoly here. I worry what's going to happen if Obama is elected. I mean, it may be that he's going to bomb Iran in October of next year, whereas Romney was going to bomb Iran in April. So that wouldn't be a huge difference. There are, on the other hand, huge differences between the two candidates on this question of a woman's right to choose. I've never seen such Neanderthal comments coming out of the Republican Party on a woman who's been raped having to carry to term the offspring of her rapist. This from Paul Ryan, not just Todd Akin, but Paul Ryan. And Romney's position on choice is abominable as well. And on gay and lesbian rights, Obama's been really good, and Romney is really bad, and so is Ryan. And there are other issues, too, where the contrasts are quite obvious. So I'm not prepared to say that there's not differences that are meaningful between the two candidates either. So progressives need to wrestle with their own conscience and decision-making and come to their own individual decisions.
Well, Matthew Rothschild, certainly people are entitled to vote whichever way they want. And that's not so much what I'm suggesting here is that I just have noticed that in this country that the political culture is pretty thin. For example, in a European, say you go to a dinner party in Europe or anywhere else in the democratic world, if you will, or the worlds of social democracies, everybody talks about politics. The last thing they talk about is what they discuss with their shrink. And it seems to me that we have a tendency to vote for the miracle worker, the man on the white horse, and we punch our ticket for democracy every couple of years or every 4 years, and we do it rather like going to the dentist. We do it out of duty but not out of passion. And the other 364 days of the year, we completely turn off from politics. So my sense is if you really want to create new political parties in this country, you've got to work at it 365 days of the year and not make that one day of the year your protest vote.
Well, I agree with you on both things, but you know, politics is a 365 day a year thing. It's not just joining in the plebiscite every 2 or every 4 years. So I totally agree with you there. But the system here is so geared, so rigged against third parties with our winner-take-all system. I mean, we need instant runoff voting and proportional representation. We don't have that here. So the two parties, you know, just have the system pretty much locked in. And, you know, what we've had here is two failed experiments over the last 50 years. We've had the failed experiment of working within the Democratic Party, because it's a corporatist party and an imperialist party, and then we've had the failed experiment of trying third-party efforts that are quixotic at best. We had the Citizens Party in 1980, we had Ralph Nader in 2000 and 2004, and other Green Party candidates that didn't get more than, you know, 2.7% at the Nader high water mark, and then an infinitesimal amount after that. And so neither of those things is working, and so we have to figure out a different strategy. And I don't think the strategy is running necessarily third-party candidates for president every 4 years, especially ones who are obscure. Rather, we need to build from the bottom up. We need to build third parties from the bottom up, and we need to build demands from the bottom up and force them upon whoever is the candidate from whichever party. I think that's more sensible, actually, than running third-party presidential candidacies that ultimately fail.
Well, you know, there have been some improvements in this broken electoral system through state initiatives. You could argue here in California the fact that they have the first two past the post get to run against each other, which is, I think, a more fairer situation. And there is an effort to end this antique relic known as the Electoral College on a state-by-state basis. Unfortunately, only Democratic states so far, or Democratic-leaning states, have voted in to get rid of the Electoral College and to have the electors apportioned based on the popular vote. And, of course, we could get to a point if that succeeded, even though it'll be constitutionally challenged, that if you got rid of the Electoral College, then all the money and attention would go to California, New York, and Texas, and the rest of the country would be in the dark as we have the opposite situation now.
Yeah, well, that's the argument for keeping the Electoral College, but I'm against it. I'm for, you know, more democracy, and I think there's no reason that the small state should have a huge influence as much influence as bigger states. So I want to get rid of the Electoral College. The Progressive magazine's been advocating for getting rid of the Electoral College for, you know, 100 years now. But I think the more important reform is actually amending the Constitution to overturn the Citizens United decision and say once and for all that money is not speech, corporations are not persons, and the government and the people have the right to regulate advertisements during elections. Otherwise, we're in a situation where we are now where billionaires can just spend unlimited amounts and corporations can spend unlimited amounts to trash this candidate and try to elect that one.
Well, and that is what we have. And just to touch on the Electoral College, though, not that you need any more reasons to want to get rid of it. I spoke with an expert on the Electoral College the other day who's been looking into who the electors have been over the last several elections. And it's pretty disturbing to find that the election does not end because the Electoral College votes in December. And if it's a tight election, all kinds of lobbying zeroes in on these electors and a couple have changed their votes, etc. And, we don't know, again, with the Citizens United environment, what kind of pressure could be brought to bear on electors if it's a tight race. I mean, so not only is it an antiquated relic of a system, it's also about as easy to game, it seems, as our broken election system is.
Yeah, and that's the real problem. But the good news is that there is a movement to amend the Constitution. There's this group Move to Amend that's getting signatures. There's Public Citizen, Ralph Nader's old group that's working hard on this. There's Senator Sherrod Brown, who is likely to get reelected today. There's Bernie Sanders in the Senate who's working on this. A lot of good people and good organizations are working on this effort to overturn Citizens United.
Well, Matthew Rothschild, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's the editor of the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin. He is one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Paul Ryan's notion that Obama is trying to destroy Judeo-Christian values and Western civilization.
Burning Isaac, Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in the second chance? Do you believe in rapture?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Posner, Senior Editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in the American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, The Religious Blogs at The Washington Post, and The Guardian, and other publications. She has an article at Religion Dispatches, Paul Ryan's Judeo-Christian Values. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Thanks, Ian.
And just yesterday in Castle Rock, Colorado, Paul Ryan was on a conference call with thousands, apparently, or tens of thousands of evangelical Christians listening in. This was organized by the evangelical leader Ralph Reed's group, Faith and Freedom Coalition.
Right.
And he basically said that Obama is putting the country on a dangerous path that compromises Judeo-Christian Western civilization values. I mean, do you know what he's talking about?
Well, while it might sound shocking and is sort of a shocking thing to say to the average listener, this is standard fare for the people who are calling in to the Faith and Freedom Coalition conference call. If they're the same type of activists who would go to the Values Voters Summit or to the annual conference that the Faith and Freedom Coalition holds in Washington or any of their state-level conferences or gatherings, this is exactly the sort of rhetoric that they would hear. It's very, very typical. And the fact, I think people were surprised by Ryan saying it because it's typically not the language he has used on the campaign trail, or the precise language that he's used on the campaign trail. But to me, it was just standard talking points for the religious right base, and it just seemed like Ryan was phoning it in.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary to see that Ralph Reed has managed to resurrect himself.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a shameless whore, really. If you've ever read his emails when he was soliciting work as a PR man for Enron, the great scam artists that took down their employees and shareholders for millions of dollars. And he was, of course, involved with Abramoff,
right,
ripping off Indian tribes. So,
in that endeavor, he was engaged in basically a double cross of evangelical groups who were opposed to gambling. And it was widely thought at the time that he would never be able to resurrect himself because religious right groups were so angry at him for this double cross. And in fact, when he first tried to re-enter politics after that, and he wasn't indicted in the Abramoff scandals, but it definitely tarnished his reputation, and he attempted to run for lieutenant governor in the Republican primary for lieutenant governor of Georgia, a state that would ordinarily be receptive to somebody with his pedigree, and he lost really badly. And people thought that he would never be able to make a comeback after that. They thought that it was the end of him. And he really played the redemption card and poured a lot of money into establishing the Faith and Freedom Coalition, saying that it would be the Christian Coalition on steroids. In fact, in a lot of states, he basically took what was left of the Christian Coalition apparatus and turned it into Faith and Freedom Coalition organizations at the state level. And I think, by and large, evangelicals have accepted this, have accepted that he is, in their mind, a very good political strategist or very good at get out the vote. And it seems like even if he has had, he still has detractors who are still bitter about the Abramoff business, nonetheless, it seems like he's been largely accepted by the political, the politically powerful, and the grassroots in playing this role, performing this function of getting the evangelical vote out.
Again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets. That's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. She has an article at Religion Dispatches, Paul Ryan's Judeo-Christian Values. Now, when we talk about the religious right, we really shouldn't be talking about the right. There's nothing religious about it. It's one of the things that infuriates me about all the political commentary in this country. It's so obvious, if you watch any of the so-called Christian television, that it's a front for right-wing politics. And the Christian part of it, the theological part of it, is completely transparent and has no moral or intellectual consistency. And you just have to go back to when the religious right really became an important player in the Republican Party with Ronald Reagan. You know, the American people, the religious people, allegedly, instead of voting for one of their own, a Baptist minister, Jimmy Carter, they voted for a divorced Hollywood actor. I mean, so I just don't know.
To the extent that they exploit or use religion to advance their political arguments, I mean, it is true. I mean, it's a religious movement. I think it's accurate to describe it as a religious movement, even if they are exploiting or misappropriating religion for their political ends. They are using a kind of religion. But when Paul Ryan uses these phrases like Judeo-Christian values and basically portending the downfall of civilization, he is evoking a very politicized movement which dates back to the Cold War, which basically says, you know, communists, Marxists, secular humanists, you know, liberals, anybody who they view as an enemy is basically in conflict with, on a collision course with, causing the downfall of what they claim is America as a Christian nation. Now, the use of the term Judeo-Christian instead of just Christian is really not very accurate because, I mean, by and large, American Jews vote Democratic. I mean, there's a small percentage of them who vote Republican, but it's not very accurate to say that American Jews are largely conservative. And it's not really Judeo-Christian. I mean, it's almost like it's just a throwaway line because it doesn't really have anything to do with Jewish values, or it's just a phrase that they've invoked to make it seem like they're a bigger coalition than they are. And it's also intended to isolate other people, Muslims, people who aren't religious. So that's what Paul Ryan was up to.
And of course, it's worth noting that most American Jews, I think up to about 90%, support abortion rights, which is an anathema to the Christian right. Again, I hate using that term because I don't think it's particularly useful. Now, the press have been absolutely pathetic in not being able to get, and so are the Democrats, frankly, in not being able to force Romney to release his taxes or his list of money bundlers. And they've also, I think, been useless on exploring his religiosity and the extent to which he's informed by the Book of Mormon and his religion. What little we know about Romney's religion is a couple of incidents where he did an interview with George Stephanopoulos, where he was asked about the connection to the end of times in the Mormon Church. And one of the things I find extraordinary about Romney's answer was that we believe, that, quoting Romney, we believe that over, and this is about the rapture, we believe that over the 1,000 years that follows the rapture, the millennium, he will reign from two places, that the law will come forward from one place, from Missouri, and the other will be Jerusalem.
So, well, I mean, that is in Mormon teaching. To the extent to which Romney really believes that, I mean, there are a lot of Mormons, just like there are a lot of Christians, who don't literally believe the end time scenario as some have depicted it in the Book of Revelation. And it bears remembering also that Mormons do not just use the Book of Mormon. They also rely on the entirety of the Bible, too, Old and New Testament. So I think the extent to which Romney literally believes this stuff is questionable. I don't think it's out of the question, but at the same time, I don't know that he has said a lot of things that would indicate a literal belief in the Mormon end time scenario. However, and I also discussed this in a post at Religion Dispatches this week, the Republican Party as a whole does rely on an evangelical base that does literally believe an end time scenario, and actually talks about it quite a bit. Talks about it far more than Mitt Romney has ever talked about it, or talks about it far more than the LDS Church talks about it publicly. If you look at figures like, John Hagee or, Jerry Falwell when he was alive, Pat Robertson, Tim LaHaye, the author of the Left Behind book, all of these people talk about all of these religious, I know you don't like to use my use of that term, religious leaders talk about this scenario as if it's very, very real. Their followers believe that it's very, very real, and some of them have they're very politically influential. They have a lot of clout they had a lot of clout in the Bush administration. They have a lot of clout with congressional members of Congress, senators, and also with various Republican presidential candidates. Rick Perry is close to some of these people. Michelle Bachmann was. Mike Huckabee was. So I think that I would be more concerned about Romney feeling beholden to these religious leaders who bring the evangelical voters to the polls every election cycle for the Republicans, as opposed to worrying about what Romney as a Mormon believes. I think he's much more susceptible to being beholden for political reasons to his base than he is to a particular end time scenario that's taught in the Mormon Church.
Well, I'm just trying to reconcile this image of the Messiah returning to Missouri. I guess Todd Aiken will greet him, right?
Yes. Well, the other thing to remember about LDS apocalyptic teaching is that while it was very commonplace during the Cold War to have that at the forefront, the contemporary Mormon Church is less focused on that sort of thing. And I think that it might have been part of the environment that Romney grew up in, given the era in which he grew up in the Mormon Church. But I think, and while obviously there are always still people who literally believe these end time scenarios in every religion that has an end time scenario, it's not clear to me that this is something that Romney ruminates on very much. And in fact, in the interview that you're talking about, his grasp of the details of this seemed, and that might have been purposeful, but his grasp of the details of it seemed a little bit thin. So I wasn't convinced that it was something that he spends a lot of time thinking about.
Right, but I think the point is, and the one I was trying to make, Sarah, is that so little of these discussions have taken place. There's so little to mine here, in terms of I mean, if Romney wins the presidency, he will set a very, very dangerous precedent where future presidents will not have to reveal where they got their money from and from whom and how much. And, you know, your personal fortune is also tied in with your personal political DNA.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think that there's a lot of questions that he hasn't answered. And I think that some of the questions that he hasn't answered about his religion that are more troubling than these questions about the end time scenario are his views on women and women's rights and what were his views of the ban on African-Americans serving in the priesthood until 1978. So I think that there are questions because he has raised his... I'm hesitant to probe candidates' religion because without them having raised it first, and he has raised it first, not necessarily in the context of the apocalypse or anything like that, but he has raised his service as a lay pastor and a lay bishop and stake president and all of that. And there have been questions raised by people who were in his stake, particularly women, about how he treated women. And I do think that those questions about his religion are relevant, questions surrounding his taxes and the tax shelter he used that benefited him and the Mormon Church. There are questions. I think that the questions about the end times would be pretty low on my list.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches, where she has an article, Paul Ryan's Judeo-Christian Values. And on Monday, Paul Ryan made the extraordinary announcement in a telephone call to evangelical Christians. He said that President Obama is putting the country on a dangerous path that compromises Judeo-Christian Western values. Now, one of the people, of course, that Romney's using as a surrogate to reach out to the evangelicals is Glenn Beck, who is a Mormon convert, but presumably because of his popularity as a radio and TV personality on the right, he has a following amongst these right-wing people who call themselves Christians. I guess that's my new way of framing it.
Okay.
So I was struck by how Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, organized a meeting FaceTime with Romney and his father, Billy Graham, who's very, very elderly and apparently quite senile. And Franklin Graham is very reactionary. He's indulged in birther conspiracies about Obama. He clearly has a burning hatred of Obama, and he apparently managed to give Romney their endorsement. And, of course, immediately from the Billy Graham Crusade website, they scrubbed all of their references to Mormonism being a cult.
Right.
So, you know, just again, it takes you back to this recognition that we're not talking about religion here. We're talking about political deal-making.
Well, on the Billy and Franklin Graham question, there are a lot of questions about whether, as you mentioned, whether this is really coming from Billy Graham or whether these are strings that are being pulled by Franklin Graham, who's been a lot more incendiary than his father, particularly, like you mentioned, with regard to Obama, but also with regard to Muslims. He's called Islam a wicked religion, and he's made a lot of really terrible, bigoted comments about that. And it was thought when Billy Graham endorsed the anti-marriage equality amendment in North Carolina, either that was last year or the year before. In any case, Graham endorsed that, and it was thought at the time by a lot of people that Franklin was the one who was really orchestrating that. And that's the same thinking by a lot of observers of Graham, religion reporters. People have a lot of questions about whether the elder Graham was really making these statements that are attributed to him in the advertisements that are pro-Romney.
Well, the idea that Franklin Graham can inherit the Billy Graham Crusades like some North Korean dictator creates a dynasty. This is a sort of religious dynasty based upon birth. That in itself is pretty extraordinary.
Well, yeah, I don't know what to say about that except that, you know, these, you know, nonprofits, they have a board, and the board apparently has decided that this is the the line of succession that they want to take.
No, it's God's will. So, just in closing then, Sarah Posner, what kind of role do you think is going to be played by these people that Ralph Reed was trying to get out, and that he claimed tens of thousands of evangelical Christians were listening in to the phone conversation with Paul Ryan, where he made the ridiculous remark that the president's put the country on a dangerous path that compromises Judeo-Christian Western civilization values. That's quite a mouthful in itself. So what do you think is going to happen on election day here with the Christian vote? Are the Christian soldiers going to come out in full numbers?
Well, I think that there will be big voter turnout among conservative Catholics and conservative evangelicals who have simultaneously been pumped up, not just in opposition to Obama generally, but in opposition to the contraception mandate, which has been portrayed to them as a violation of their religious freedom. And, you know, obviously in states that have a significant evangelical or Catholic or both population, you know, any voter turnout can make a difference if the election is close. I don't know that we have confirmation of the numbers that Reed is claiming to have influence over. I have a press release in my inbox that says that the Faith and Freedom Coalition made over 122 million voter contacts in key states to evangelicals and Catholics, 23 million pieces of mail, 21 million get-out-the-vote calls, 18 million text messages. This is a lot of money that's being spent and paid to some firm that's doing this work. And so, but the question are the numbers really that large, and is that what the voter turnout is going to be? I think that remains to be seen, and I think that the really interesting thing to look at with this voter turnout will be the 18 to 29-year-old cohort, which has a much smaller percentage of these religious voters than the older cohort.
Mm. Well, clearly this is the Republican Southern strategy and Northern strategy working hand in hand. I thank you so much for joining us, Sarah Posner.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, The Religion Blog at The Washington Post, and The Guardian, and other publications. She has an article at Religion Dispatches, Paul Ryan's Judeo-Christian Values. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.